like to briefly give her an opportunity to review that. And actually, in the process, I could just briefly review the process of generating Maria's sort of action items and the minutes, just to clarify the intent and to clear up some of the dialogue that we saw from Milton and Vittorio last week, and as well as clarify any questions that Marilyn may have about the minutes themselves. Then move on to spend most of our call on a discussion of approaches to tiered access, and then I'd like to reserve a little bit of time at the end of the call to potentially discuss if the task force has any fairly unified feedback to the proposed terms of references that Bruce has drafted. Most of that discussion probably belongs at the council level, but to the extent that the United Task Force has feedback, I'm sure the council would appreciate that. Any other suggestions or additions to the agenda for today? Great. So I'd like to move to a brief discussion, first, of the process that we use to generate, just the roles of the two documents that we're getting. Well, there's really three things we get each week at this point. From the staff, the first is very soon after the call, Glenn posts an MP3 recording of the call that is entirely sort of factual in nature, obviously, and not intended to convey any judgments. Second thing we get is from Maria sort of an action point summary, and my understanding of that document is it is intended only to summarize the action items that people have agreed to, plus a very, very high-level summary of the discussion for context, but it's not intended to be part of the sort of ongoing record of the task force. And then lastly, we get, somewhat later, the minutes that Glenn posts that are intended to be part of the record and summarize the I think, a very good job of summarizing the discussions on the call in some detail. Is that the intent that staff sees as well in producing these inputs, Maria or Glenn?
For Maria, yeah, that's pretty much it, yep.
Yes, for me too, it's pretty much the same. And if there are any comments to be made or changes, I'm always prepared to do it. In these last minutes, there has been one by Milton, which I will get out as quickly as possible after this call.
Thanks, Glenn. So do we have any questions just about the process or concerns about how it's being implemented at this point?
Jordan, it's Marilyn. Can I get in the queue or make a comment?
Yeah, sure. Marilyn, anyone else want to speak to this?
David Maher joining.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess, David.
Yeah.
Anyone else with questions or comments on this process?
On what process?
The various inputs that are produced by the staff each week.
Yeah, Kathy.
Kathy, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, Marilyn, go ahead.
I want to commend the staff for initiating the action summary. I do think it's an excellent quick turnaround. I'd just like to make one suggestion. I appreciate the statement that you noted that the action summary is not supposed to be part of the ongoing record. Let me suggest that since the action summary does, I think, summarize the actions that are going to be taken, that those actions should then be replicated in the minutes. That the section of the action summary that is, because otherwise we're going to have a disjointment between the minutes and the purpose of the action summary, which I think is supposed to tell us all, remind us of what we agreed to as actionable items. And that would say to me that in the minutes, Glenn would want to pick up the listing of the actionable items.
Yeah, that does seem like a useful suggestion, is to pull them out from the sort of text, the broader text of the minutes.
And it might be a good idea to just rename that from action summary to you know, maybe preliminary summary or something that is very neutral, particularly if the intent is not to treat it as a part of the ongoing record, but to be an informal summarization, then we should probably, you know, just use language that is clearer, maybe. But I do think it's a very, very helpful addition.
Thanks, Marilyn. Kathy?
I wanted to reflect Marilyn's thoughts that this is a good addition. The action summary is a very good addition to what's going on with the task forces. It's a quick focus on what needs to be done, and it's actually something I've used for many years.
Tony Harris.
That I've used for many years with committees. But to say it's not part of the ongoing record surprises me, because it's going to the same list that's being archived. It is part of the record. It is something people are going to refer to. And if there's no reflection of the concern, or in our case, in the non-commercial constituencies case on one item, the downright opposition to something, then it really implies kind of a consensus on the step going forward. No one is going to know, reviewing it now or in the future, because it is part of the public record, that there was this real concern, and that can become, everybody can kind of be swept up with, this is the next action point, rather than at the very outset of that action point, there were groups that said no, that this isn't the right way to go. So I really think that it should be reflected in the action summary, if there is real concern about a step.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the challenge there, Kathy, from my perspective, is just separating, is just avoiding having that document get bogged down with sort of various sort of policy statements, and have it be mostly a reflection, a very high-level reflection of the conversation that took place, and a quick turnaround in terms of what people committed to do prior to the next call, as opposed to the minutes, which I think are intended to reflect the full scope of dialogue that occurred during the call.
Jordan, if you could put me in the queue.
Yeah, sure. Ross and anyone else?
Jordan, can I respond to that briefly?
Yeah, sure. Why don't you briefly respond, and then
okay.
I'll turn it over to Ross.
Because we're looking at something where the action summary starts at the we're at the very beginning of the action. And one way to do it so that you have a balancing action item might be to ask the group that dissented to the action completely to write a brief statement about it, to submit it, to be submitted to the task force, and then you can list that action item as well. And then you've got all items showing kind of a balance of views.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Ross, is your comment on this point, or
yes, it is.
So let me turn it to Ross and then Marilyn.
Sure.
You know, generally speaking, I think the comments regarding the form of this communication are very, very helpful. Hopefully, we can keep this discussion to a minimum because it's formative, not substantial. But just generally, as a tip for those that want to assure that that record includes their views. You know, it's always useful to say, I would like this statement to be included in the record. But whether or not that shouldn't be included in the summary, it is indeed a summary. So, you know, I think we should just continue to treat it as such and probably move on with this discussion.
Thanks. Marilyn, question?
My point, I think I probably am aligning myself with the most recent previous speaker, Mr. Rader, but my point is just, we don't want to turn this summary into either competition or duplication to the minutes. So maybe we could ask the staff to take into account the comments they've heard and to think themselves about how to make sure that the actionable summary or the whatever it is, you know, maybe it keeps on being called what it is, but kind of like try to define, let's make sure it's not just new competition and asking the staff to do two versions of minutes.
Yeah, and I think Maria has agreed that on an ongoing basis she's going to try to be sensitive to the when reflecting what are quote unquote agreed upon points. If there's if there is not unanimity about that within the task force, to be careful about reflecting that. I think, Kathy, to your specific suggestion, the only problem I see is that we this action summary, we want to have turned back to the list quite quickly. And to the extent that we're then have to go back and solicit, you know, additional inputs, I think any constituency is free to respond. I mean, as Milton and Vittoria both did this week, they're free to respond to the action summary and express, you know, whatever statement they want that, that also becomes part of the of the of the record, quote unquote, in the mailing list archives, to the same extent that the action summary does. So that seems to me like a fairly easy way to make sure that viewpoint is expressed as well.
I like the idea that the official, what you opened with, that the official action summary will also reflect the difference of opinion. Will the current one be edited to kind of reflect that as well? I know it seems like a minor point for most people, but I've watched action items take on lives of their own repeatedly. Once it's down in print, it becomes something the group is behind doing. And in this case, we don't have that consensus.
Right. Well, so...
I have another question for
yeah,
you.
Go ahead.
And that's it. Thank you.
Marilyn.
You know, I'm just trying to think about what the most... Because what we're trying to do, I think, is to agree on what the tools are that support the work of the task force and then support the ability of the staff when they are documenting the work of the task force, you know, what are the authoritative documents they go to, so to speak. If we agree that the actionable items would be pulled out of this report and repeated in the minutes, then that might be a way of ensuring or helping to ensure that, you know, we're not creating a competing document because it wouldn't be the entirety of the report that got pulled into the minutes. It would just be the actionable items that people need to be going back to see what the work assignment is. I do think that's an important, helpful addition. And then asking the staff, as you already have, and as Maria has already indicated, to be sensitive to this point maybe helps us as well.
Yeah. So I think there you've suggested what I'd propose to resolve this the current issue, which is as opposed to going back and editing the action point summary, which I view as a point in time document that's expressing here's what we need to do for the next week. I'd suggest that we do issue a new version of the minutes that includes the actionable items from the action point summary, and to the extent that people don't believe that the action points reflected in the minutes reflect something agreed upon by the task force as a whole and want to indicate some sort of caveat, then I think that's the appropriate place for it as opposed to going back and editing the action point summary. So the exact same points that are action items will be incorporated into the minutes, but and that's the place where we could theoretically, if you think that it's appropriate to do so, Kathy or Milton, to add whatever sort of reservation the NCUC may have on the action items.
Can I comment, Jordan?
Sure.
Yeah, it's not about the NCUC. I think this we're probably spending too much time on this, but here's the nub of the issue. Okay, if I totally agree that it's great for the staff to try to extract key action items when there are indeed agreed action items and to run them quickly out and remind us that we actually do these things because we all know what happens with these committees. We agree to do things and they never happen. I think it's incumbent upon the chair of the committee and the staff to simply to be careful that the things they put forward as action items are really action items, and that they are agreed upon by everyone on the committee. And if they're not agreed upon and somebody objects to them, they simply have to be withdrawn.
Yeah,
they clearly cannot be agreed items if somebody objects to them.
So that's understood, Milton, and something that I think we've already, that both Maria and I have already committed to be sensitive to on an ongoing basis.
So I don't think we need to do anything more than that. Just be intelligent and flexible about how we actually implement this idea of the action item list.
great. Okay. So, moving on then. And hopefully very briefly, Marilyn, you said you had some questions about last week.
Well, it's really kind of a nit, but it's just I just wanted to point out, I don't think Tim is on the call, but Glenn, if you would go back to Tim, there's one summary that where it says, Tim Ruiz made the point that being able to contact someone was far more accurate to his company, how accurate the data might look. I think the word was probably important there. That's a little thing, but that's not really what I wanted to raise. What I wanted to raise is in several places there was work suggested, either like Jordan, you asked Maria to inquire about numbers and outcomes in the WDPRS, the WHOIS Data Problem Report. There's a couple of other kind of work assignments. My question was just, it wasn't really clear to me in the minutes, and I apologize for missing the meeting, exactly how the feedback was going to come into the task force. So I just wanted to ask that question and ask to have that answer also inserted in the minutes so that it would be reflected there as well.
Sure, and I'll try to keep this brief. I think the short-term answer is that the answers are being delivered to the mailing list. Maria's already given the feedback on the WHOIS data problem reporting system. And in the longer term, to the extent when we have our next substantive call on the accuracy topic, then we may also ask for an oral report at that time.
Okay.
But in the short term, it's just feedback to the list.
Okay. My second question to the staff is that when task force members make reference to presentations that could be provided by a link, I'd like to ask that we try to do that. Steve Metallis mentioned an OECD presentation in Bucharest as documentation. It's sometimes very hard to find those resources. That happens to just be one that I noticed. I think that will come up from time to time on other issues. And if we can provide the link in the body of the minutes on an ongoing basis, that will be helpful to the task force members and to the staff in further work.
Thanks, Marilyn.
That's it.
Okay, great. So, unless hopefully there's no more comments on the minutes, we will move on to this week's actual substantive agenda, which is a discussion of the tiered access or access to data topic. I forwarded to the list over the last couple of days two previous documents that were submitted to, I think they were both submitted to Task Force 2. It's possible one of them was submitted to the Joint Task Force 1 and 2. But I think they were both the Task Force 2. A document from, I believe, from the Registrar's Constituency submitted by Tom Keller, a draft statement from the Registrar's Constituency, and indicating a broad outline for a proposal for a tiered access system. Secondly, a proposal from Thomas Ressler of the ALAC suggesting a possible PKI-based implementation of an authentication system for a tiered access model, and I think based broadly speaking on some of the guidelines that Task Force 2 had suggested for the implementation of a tiered access system. In addition to those two items, we've also had, over the past couple of months, submissions or discussion from various TLD operators, including .name, .de, .ca. Am I missing one? I don't think so. As to various approaches that those TLDs take with regards to limiting access to WHOIS data, and recently, as you've seen, .name launched a beta version of their tiered access approach, which previously had been incorporated into their contract but had not yet been implemented. It now seems that they're on the path, at least, to implement that approach. So we do have a number of, I guess, documented approaches to the problem. But it feels to me that initially I had thought that it might be useful to talk through some of those approaches and their strengths and weaknesses, but it may be useful to take a further step back and simply examine the various, this may be the engineer in me speaking, but before we try to solve a problem, to look at the requirements and use cases that we're trying to get at, and examine the various purposes that Who is used for. And I know we won't necessarily all agree as to whether or not the various purposes are, that's the relative merits of their validity, but I think it would be good to at least document the various uses that Who is made of today, and then I think we could take from that and formulate opinions about the whether or not we think that those are essential to the ongoing operation of Who is, and then ensure that whatever policy proposal we suggest is built around supporting at least the various uses and requirements that have been articulated at this phase. So I would suggest perhaps it might be useful to spend a little bit of time today talking about current use cases for Who is data and the way that Who is data is used today and the specific objectives that people try to make use of Who is data for.
And Jordan, it's Marilyn, just to clarify, and you're suggesting we do what we would think of as a whiteboarding exercise without prejudging our personal attitudes about the use, but just identify them?
Correct. And then later, I think later sure. we could go and think about whether we think that these are either actual requirements or uses that people are making that don't seem to be a requirement of the system, or that seem inconsistent with ICANN policy or whatever.
Sure.
But for now, at least, simply to identify the current uses that are made of Who is.
Okay.
Okay. Well, hearing no objection to that, I'd invite people to articulate uses of the Who is system today.
I'll start.
Sure.
Who is today is used by large businesses and small businesses to identify a name that they want to use, or to identify a name that is already in use because they are thinking about introducing a new service or product, and they want to find out what other names are in the market, so to speak, so that they can avoid trademark or confusing their customers, or in some cases because they want to confuse their customers by introducing a name that is very similar to an existing name. It's also used for purposes of trademark policing, dealing with phishing attacks, dealing with other kinds of network attacks. ISPs, not just ISPs, but also big network providers and companies that operate networks of their own use it as well to deal with the same kind of DDoS, phishing, other kinds of network attacks, and they use both the just a shortcut. If they use both the DNS Who is and the IP Who is well.
Okay, thanks for the list.
Can I get in the queue, Tony Harris?
Yeah, sure, Tony. Can I ask you some follow up questions, Marilyn, just to add some more detail to this?
You can, but you probably want to take the full list maybe before.
Well, I just want to make sure as we're enumerating each of these that we get a little bit of detail about how the information might actually, what information from Who is might be required to support that purpose and or, basically that. So for example, the first thing you mentioned is that businesses might want to make use of the, just want to check whether a name is in use or not already. So they're...
Or who it's been used by, because they're introducing a competitive product, And so, you know, there, let's say I'm introducing a new consulting service, and I'm going to name my business. God, that might be pretty close to home here. And I'm going to name my business something. So I'm looking to see what my competitors have named their business or what other names are out there in use and who they're in use by, because it will affect my competitive entry into the market.
Okay, so there we're looking for whether or not a name is registered and who is using it.
Yep.
Is that correct? So then the second example you gave was for policing trademark
mm-hmm.
information there, and what would people be looking for in that case?
Just to use the company that I still advise as an example, looking to see if names are being, if a name that is either registered to that particular company or is a confusingly similar name is being registered and is who it's in use by, in order to deal with infringement, customer confusion, other kinds of problems. But for the most part, for the large companies and the small companies that I've worked with, it has to do with avoiding customer confusion. There's a particular, and very small companies often do their own trademark policing themselves because they don't hire outside counsel. Somebody on the staff or even the CEO goes out and looks themselves to make sure that their brand is not being violated or misused in some way. The Net Nanny example a few years ago was one that actually got a fair amount of press, where NetNanny is a filtering company that the software is used to protect kids online, and someone had registered a almost exact replica of the name with marketing access to child pornography and pornography. And
great. So there again, they want the information that who the name is registered by. Is that, would that be a fair summary of what they're looking for?
And how to contact that entity.
And would be to follow up on the, not to identify whether infringement's taking place, but to somehow follow up to notify them of the infringement or take some sort of action about it. Is that correct?
You know, follow up can range all the way from following up to say cease and desist. This is likely to be aware of it. Something stronger than that. To follow up being, hi, I have your name registered, your website doesn't seem to be active, I'm interested in purchasing the name from you.
Okay, so it sounds like there we want, the objective is to know who is registered a name and how to contact them. And then the last case you mentioned was sort of a series of sort of either phishing or various sort of attacks that might be made. And what would specifically would the security departments be looking for to try to get from the Whois information there?
Okay, remember that I'm talking about really from my history of advising companies who operate their large networks, and I think there are ISPs and ISP representatives on the call who should also address this. We generally are encountering some kind of attack on the network or a phishing problem, and you are looking for any means possible to take the site down or to find the person to contact to advise them that they are participating in an attack. It's not always the case that the initial apparent culprit is aware that they may be engaged in a drone problem or some other kind of problem, or they may be being used as a relay on SAM. It's not always the first point of the first person that you contact that ends up being the responsible party for the problem that's being generated in the network. So you're looking for contact information, and you need probably more than one form of contact information in dealing with these attacks. They are typically urgent contact. And most of the phishing assaults take place beginning at 6 p.m. on Friday and run through the weekend.
Okay, great. So it sounds like there the objective is either to notify the person operating the site of the problem or to take the site down. Is that the
right.
objective? Okay,
right.
Great. Okay, Tony, does anyone else want to be in the queue? Okay, go ahead. Steve, okay. Okay, Tony.
Well, we put some of these in a report we sent out in 2004 to the WHOIS task force that was working at that time. That was, which basically says ISPCP uses of WHOIS data from the ISPCP, which says number one would be to research and verify domain registrants that could vicariously cause liability for ISPs because of illegal, deceptive, or infringing content. I can give you an example right away. We registered for our own association, Kabase, kabase.org.ar. We recently found that there is a kabase.com.ar, which points to a porno site. So obviously we were very... very active in trying to establish who the identity of who was doing this. It was obviously an attempt to discredit our association or in some way harm us. So I think it's a pretty good example of why you do need to have some data where you can follow something like that up. Point two would be to prevent or detect sources of security attacks of the networks and servers. Always referred to ISPs, of course. Number three would be to identify sources of consumer fraud, spam, and denial of service attacks and incidents. Four, we listed to effectuate UDRP proceedings. And five, to support technical operations of ISPs or network administrators. that was something we submitted actually about over a year ago in one of these submissions that we were asked to do about WHOIS. And I think it pretty well summarizes some of the things that ISPs are concerned with, the main things that ISPs are concerned with as regards to data, to accurate and available data. Okay?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. Could I follow up just briefly on a couple of those to just try to once again get at what specifically you'd be looking for in each of those cases? The first one you said you want to research, I guess, and identify registrant information where there's some conflict with an ISP's
presence. Where they vicariously cause liability.
Vicariously cause liability. And so
we want to throw them in jail. It's as simple as that.
Okay, so there you want a way to track down the person and serve legal papers or send the police to their house or something like that. Is that the goal?
Yeah, I'd go there and beat the guy up myself in this case. But, yeah, that's the gist of it.
Okay.
Or Tony, it's Marilyn, is that, or you want to be able to contact, I mean, you may not be serving them.
I'm sorry, I don't follow you, Marilyn.
Are you suggesting that it would be the ISP who would be...
No, not at all. It's just a joke. What I'm saying is it's really useful to be able to identify the culprit in this case or similar cases.
Right. The end game is to be able to have legal proceedings take place with regards to the domain holders.
Yes, and protect the ISP from the liability involved because. Behind the ISP, you've got a user, right? An internet user. If he runs into some difficulty or some strange situation involving another website, he's going to go to his ISP either for help or you know, to tell them what's this all about. You get spam every day, which has websites included in the spam content, right? And you're pointed to this constantly. If you're not careful and you go into one of these websites, you could end up having something installed in your PC, which would destroy your hard disk or do all kinds of things. So the ISP is sitting in the middle there. That's what I'm getting at.
Okay, so understood. So it sounds like you want to initiate legal proceedings or possibly just take down the site in some cases as well. Is that
That could be, and on the other hand, an ISP could be in the process, in the proceedings of having received some citation from a judge or something, requesting some definite action on one of these things.
Sure. Okay.
Which happens quite frequently, actually.
Okay. So the next two you said basically related to security attacks or consumer attacks. Once again, there, what's the, you're trying to just identify the source of the problem? Is that?
It's not the only source an ISP would look at in a DOS attack, obviously, but everything that that is related or can be traced in the event of an attack on the networks and servers, I think every element is really, the ISP wants to have that available if possible.
Jordan,
go ahead.
This is Ken Stubbs. Would you put me in the queue, please, Jordan?
Yes, you are after Steve Metallic.
And you mentioned you mentioned number three, identify sources of consumer fraud, or am I wrong?
And Tony, it seems like, so is the goal there just to, I'm trying to clarify what the goal behind each of these actions are. Is it to get in touch with someone, or is it to take the site down, both?
Well, in the case of an attack, really, it's a means of tracing the culprit again. I mean, when you have an attack on your network or server, you're not worried about taking down a website. You're just trying to get to the cause and see where you can cut it off.
So there you're just purely using the data for sort of as an information.
As a tracing,
point.
Yes.
Point, okay. And then to effectuate UDRP procedure, you just need someone to contact to initiate the UDRP, is that?
Well, it would help, obviously.
Yeah. Understood. And then finally, contact information for other ISPs. There you're just looking to get a phone number or an email address of someone to get in touch with, is that?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
Technical contact is important.
Right.
And you didn't mention and identify sources of consumer fraud, spam, but for instance, I don't know if people ever trace the Nigerian fraud or things like that, but, it could be useful for some things that you see coming up all the time.
Great.
And things to do with bank accounts where they're asking you to do all kinds of things.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Tony. Steve? Did we lose Steve? Steve Metallic, going on?
I'm sorry.
Oh, there we are. Okay.
I had unmuted myself. I think Marilyn and Tony covered a lot of the territory, and of course there's a lot of other information on this going back to the Montreal program. One use I recall there from Jane Mutimer's presentation was use of WHOIS by companies trying to manage their own portfolios of domain names, whether they're doing it directly or using a vendor to do that. Many companies don't really know what domain names they have. I think the I would expand a little bit on what Marilyn and Tony have already said about domain names that resolve to sites where illegal activity is going on, and case of the IPC, that's often trademark counterfeiting and copyright piracy, but there obviously are a lot of other illegal activities that could be involved, and this is one source of information, both, I think, to anticipate your question, both to try to contact the registrant in some cases, or the party responsible for the site, but in other cases simply to trace it so that you know how you can proceed to try to get the site taken down. And I would also say, I think Tony already said this, but that it's not simply a question of identifying the registrant. Often administrative or technical contact is needed in order for you to achieve these objectives. So I think that's all I have to add, except to say that there is, you know, we did ask each constituency this question, and there's some very voluminous responses, I think, about 2 years ago that I hope that the minutes would link to.
Yeah, I think you're right, Steve. It will be worth going back. I'm just trying to clarify a little bit here today. You know what the I think we do have a lot of lists of uses of the who is, and what I'd like to get a little bit more out of today is the requirements sort of the system for fulfilling that particular activity. So, for example, you in your example where you talked about illegal activity, it sounds like the two sort of objectives there would be either to try to contact the registrant or to potentially take the site down. Those are the two you articulated. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's also some cases where you want to initiate legal action.
Right. Okay. So there might be three. So each of these, it just seems like what you need in order to fulfill the use, you know, may be a little different. Like, for example, Tony's last use of trying to get in touch with other ISPs there, the technical contact's probably of preeminent importance as opposed to, you know, when you're trying to serve legal papers on someone, you really want to know who the owner of that domain name is or the holder of that domain name is.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think it would vary depending.
Jordan.
Yeah, Marilyn?
I want to come back at some point. I don't agree with the interpretation you just made. I think it's much too subjective, and I'd like to discuss it a bit further, but I want to wait until everyone's had a chance to read it.
Sure. Okay, understood. So I think Ken is next from the queue.
Thank you, Jordan. Hold on for a second. Let me take my phone off speakerphone. I'm traveling. There are a couple of things. First of all, to a great extent, I think the display of the data has to be directly related, or should esoterically be directly related to the nature of the owner. In other words, what I'm trying to get to is this. Financial institutions, organizations provide services and products to the public, businesses, I think it's incumbent on them to provide more information for use by the public. I don't know how we'll ever get to the point where we can enforce this, but I think I'm going to give you a clear example why I think this information is needed. I live in a retirement community in Florida, and somebody over the years has acquired a lot of email addresses in there, and we're constantly being phished for financial institutions to provide information on access, on accounts, and so forth. And sometimes the only way that you can really do something quickly to get something done would be to contact the actual financial institution itself and let them know about what's going on. In other words, I'll give you an example, SunTrust Bank. I get phished regularly for them. Now, the best way to contact that bank is not to go necessarily to their website. And if you try to contact a local law enforcement agency, I've got news for you. I think most of you are aware of the fact that most law enforcement agencies really don't have the slightest idea how to deal with this until you get into a very specialized level and possibly, let's say the FBI or so forth. But the easiest thing to do is to be able to contact the business or the financial institution to let them know exactly what's going on and let them use their resources to resolve the problem. And in most cases, it's done very, very quickly. If we don't have access to that kind of contact information in a public format, whether it's a matter of having a fax number or an email address or something for the owner of the domain, it just makes it even more effective for the people who are using these phishing attacks. So I guess what I'm really saying is that if you're a private individual, there may be stratification in terms of the obligations to provide the data publicly. But if you're an institution that's providing goods and services, I think that there's an obligation there that goes to protect the institution, but to protect the customers and give the customers a, you know, that we've talked about before in terms of obligations on the part of the registrants, but I think that obligation may very well go even further. Thanks.
Ken, can I ask you a question? Or Jordan, can I ask Ken a question?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask one too, but go ahead, Russ.
From the perspective of the registries, what do you need the WHOIS for?
Well, when you say what does a registry need a WHOIS for,
what do you need
I guess,
from the WHOIS, from the system, from the data, what do you use it for?
Well, frankly, you know as well as I do, Ross, the registries are essentially reflecting the data. I think it would depend to a great extent on the responsibilities imposed on the registries. In the case of a thick registry, it's for us at this point in time, it's principally a contractual requirement. Now, I can't speak. Rom would probably be in a much better position to speak on this issue than I would. But I think that at this point in time, the registries really don't do anything with the WHOIS data. You don't see marketing, and you do not see direct contacts with the registrants by the registries. That's all contractually managed through the ICANN process. So, I mean, that I suppose the answer to that would be that's a good question, Ross. I think for all intents and purposes, it would be difficult to justify the need except for the ability to maintain redundancy in the event of a failure on the part of the registrar, or, you know, as well as I do, I wish every registrar was as careful as, let's say, Two Cows is in maintaining redundancy in escrowing data and making sure there are many registrars that are not necessarily doing as an effective job of maintaining their records as they should in a redundant manner.
Thank you.
I have a question about the registry.
Yeah, go ahead, ma'am.
So let me see if I can ask the question if generally we have the ability to answer it, and if not, perhaps we can punt it over to Rom or someone else. I'm just thinking about talking about how WHOIS is used. I was under the impression that I would be having to take two steps to get full access to the WHOIS data in a thick registry.
What do you mean by two steps, Marilyn?
If I'm an ISP and I am or a large business holder or a small business holder and I am trying to police my trademark, for instance, let's say that I am a small business owner and I'm trying to police my trademark and I think that other people out there are registering forms of MCADE, shame on them. And I am looking to in the .info, and so I go to the registrar WHOIS, but it's I'm looking for .mk.info, mk.net, mk.biz, mk.com. What's the difference between the thick registry and the thin registry in terms of my experience?
Well, the principal difference, yeah, with .com and .net, the thin registries, you'll get a referral from the registry to the registrar.
Right. Right.
In the thick registries, the registrar still maintain the WHOIS as well, but you should get much or all of the same data that you would get from the registrar from the registry, so you don't have to go to the registrar's WHOIS. You'd be able to get most of that data from the registry, perhaps with the exception of that name in the near future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That was my understanding. I just wanted to be sure that I was still operationally.
Yeah,
okay.
That's correct.
Yeah, right now you have a redundancy. You can generally get the information from one or two sources, either the registry or the registrar.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Was anyone else in the queue?
Yes, Wendy.
Oh, Wendy, go ahead.
I just wanted to, since we had a long discussion about records earlier that I came in for the end of, I just wanted to make a note for the record that what we're talking about here is historical uses of WHOIS data that are made because the WHOIS currently provides a convenient form for that information. And while some of these things may be very useful and valuable to the people who make the uses, nothing here is saying those are always uses that have to be provided through the WHOIS, and that as we balance privacy interests, the registrants have validly against those uses, some of these uses may well not be provided either so conveniently or at all through the WHOIS as we now know it.
Correct. Wendy, we had already sort of clarified that we're enumerating uses here without making judgments as to their appropriateness or whether we think they're good uses or should be supported by the WHOIS or anything like that.
Okay, and then I suppose I might have added that other uses that have historically been made of the WHOIS include finding people to harass them, finding people who would prefer that their private information remain private in order to serve frivolous takedown demands or frivolous cease and desist notices on them, finding people who thought that their information was being kept private even through proxy registration services and invading free speech interests and intimidating people who thought that they were speaking privately or with relative anonymity from making lawful speech.
Right. Can I get in queue to go on with listing some of the uses?
You can. Does anyone else want to be in that queue? Do any? Let me specifically say ask. I know that there's at least one use that registrars make of the WHOIS. So I might ask a registrar to articulate that use, or not. Maybe I'll just put it in the record that
I could do it.
Okay, Paul.
Transfers.
Yeah, thanks. We'll just. And you need the email address in order to initiate a transfer, is that right? Do you need anything else?
No. Depends if you're talking thick or thin or whatever, but yeah, email address.
Theoretically, you can use any of that contact data, but practically it's just email address, yeah. Admin and registrant specifically.
Actually, I have a question about that. You actually need to know, you need a little bit more than the email address, don't you? I mean, you need to know what the name is and who the registrant is?
No, as long as we can contact the registrant.
You only need the email address because you can send the email address a code, and if they click on that code, then you know that, that confirms that the registrant is authorized to transfer.
Yeah, but Paul, I think it's important to, that code actually is a surrogate for the authority to complete the transfer. Not everybody in the task force necessarily understands that.
Whether they understand it or not, you only need the email address.
Yeah, just to clarify, the current transfer policy allows a transfer to be authorized in one of three ways, I believe, and some of you that were on the transfers task force can clarify this, but one is to receive a confirmation from the email address listed as by the registrant or the admin contact. So in that case, in that particular case, that's all you need in order to authorize the transfer. The two other cases would require more information, and that would be a valid electronic signature, and then you would need to know who was supposed to be providing the signature. And the third way would be to get a physical copy of the FOA that's supported by notarized sort of identity document. And in that case, you would need to know, once again, you need additional information beyond the email address. But I think in that first case, it's sufficient under the current transfer policy to receive confirmation from the email address. So you don't need anything other than that in order to authorize the transfer under that particular case.
As long as that is the, that person is listed as the administrative contact, isn't it?
Yeah, the registrant, either the registrant or the admin contact.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So Marilyn, you wanted to articulate some more uses?
To GetNetWise, which is a site that focuses on coaching parents on how to protect their kids online, has historically encouraged and so is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, encourage the youth of WHOIS for parents who are concerned about what sites their children are visiting. I know from previous work that I have done, rather extensive work that I have done up until about 2 years ago with law enforcement, that law enforcement also uses WHOIS data. And we had some presentations in Montreal, including from the U.S. Department of Justice, that talked about their uses of WHOIS. WHOIS is also being used now by, in a transborder a crime investigation having to do with drugs and other crimes that are being investigated by law enforcement. And I think while we don't necessarily have full detail on that within this group, I think we need to note the uses by law enforcement.
Jordan, it's Kathy.
Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
I'm going to second Wendy on this, that I really think that, for the record, we have to get some balance in. I know we're listing uses of the WHOIS, but, you know, in each of the examples that have been given, there are very legitimate reasons why the WHOIS should not be globally available. On the law enforcement side, I have a number of friends who work on sting operations. Their job is to go out there and pretend to be something in order to catch pedophiles, in order to catch spammers and scammers, and their WHOIS information is not accurate on purpose so that they can run the sting operations. The Department of Justice in Montreal has since recognized and acknowledged that there are freedom of expression issues, that there are rights of human rights organizations and civil rights groups, and those who monitor corruption of governments and large corporations, that they not be immediately trackable, that they wouldn't be able to publish their very legal speech if everything was globally available. And in response, again, just for balance purposes, for some of the small business issues that have been raised on the call, many small businesses, at least in the U.S., the most rapidly growing group is home-based businesses. Many of those are run by moms who are at home working part-time or full-time. And those moms have expressed in many different forms very great concerns over the requirement that they put their home address, their home phone number, their children's address in a globally available database, particularly since most of these small businesses are doing business to business. They're not, the studies have shown that they're working again business to business, not necessarily with the public, and that they're run by individuals who may have unlisted telephone numbers. So, sorry, but there are other sides again to everything here.
In other words, there's also bad uses for the WHOIS data.
Absolutely.
Right, I think,
nobody's ever said anything to the contrary.
Yeah, so I think Wendy articulated some bad uses for the WHOIS data, which will also be included in the minutes. Kathy, were you articulating some reasons why the data shouldn't be public necessarily, but are you aware of any other bad uses other than the ones that Wendy listed?
Well,
or what you would consider to be bad uses? Let me.
Actually, what I've considered is kind of good reasons not to include the data, or reasons that it's not as important for certain groups, that sometimes they have use. I mean, the same groups that have legitimate uses for global, you know, for publicly available data also have legitimate uses for not posting their own data. So it's not bad uses, it's kind of good reasons that for law enforcement, for freedom of speech, for small businesses to not post the data.
Sure. So the next thing, I mean, the next exercise I think would be useful on this topic would be to look at the, so we've articulated a list of reasons that it's useful. I think once we get this list, we can start to have some more fruitful discussion around, you know, how important we think they are, you know, whether the WHOIS ought to support the uses, et cetera, et cetera. What I think another important follow-up point is to talk about the general, to the extent we think that there's failings in the current WHOIS implementation, either because it doesn't provide privacy, it doesn't provide enough capability in terms of locating the information that's actually needed, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a useful follow-up conversation in terms of building requirements around access to the data. And so I think that is something that we ought to spend some time on in the near future. Unfortunately, we have 20 minutes left today, and I think that's probably an exhaustive conversation in its own right. So I do think we do want to have that conversation. Would encourage people. What I'll try to do in the future for these sort of substantive calls is to put together a list of topics surrounding each one that we could that we can explore on the calls. And certainly, I encourage people to continue to put comments on the list as well. But I think here we have a list of uses, both beneficial and potentially not beneficial, that we can enumerate and then start to look at how the WHOIS system supports it and whether it ought to be doing so. Any other comments on this particular topic?
Okay. The topic is uses of WHOIS,
uses,
right? Because I heard a lot of other things coming up just now.
Yeah, we're going to talk about those other things later, but right now the topic is only the uses.
Okay.
Okay, great. So I'm going to close out that conversation. I'm going to put together a list of follow-up topics that I think will be useful on the topic of access to data, and we can prioritize, hopefully, on the list. I think it is beneficial to have the ability to interact on some of these topics. With that in mind, I'm gonna move on to our last topic on the agenda today, which is to discuss briefly Bruce's proposed terms of reference. We have
Gordon.
Yeah,
Gordon.
Marilyn.
I think we just need to have at least 3 minutes reserved to remind everyone about the status of our report that we have out for public comment.
Actually, why don't I do that right now, and then we'll move for our last 15 minutes of this call to the discussion of the terms of reference and see if there's any consensus recommendations we'd make to council about it. We do have our, just as a reminder to everyone, the public comment period for our first recommendation, that on notification of registrants on use of data, is rapidly coming to a close. I believe it closes on Friday or Thursday. Is that right?
Thursday.
So a couple more days to comment. Certainly, if task force members have comments or they know people that have comments, it would be prudent to post those in the very near future. Had a handful so far.
Jordan, I have a question for Glenn. Is Glenn on the call?
Glenn is on the call.
Yes, I'm Tony.
Yes, you were supposed to get the belated ISPCP contribution to this a couple of weeks ago. Did you actually receive it?
No, I didn't receive it.
That's strange. You should have got. We were way behind with our submission, but you should have received it at least 2 weeks ago. Well, I'll see what happened then.
Okay.
Thanks, Tony, because we haven't seen it on the list either. So
I mean, I drafted it. It was approved. So I'll see what happened.
Thanks. Yes. So far, we have two comments about the recommendation. So we will have those comments. Should once those are made, Maria is going to draft a draft final report for us to discuss. She'll publish it no later than Monday, and then on Tuesday we will have next Tuesday's call is to discuss to see if there's any revisions that we feel need to be made to that report prior to it being forwarded to council for action.
Jordan, who are those two comments from?
The two comments so far are from Bruce Tonkin and Alan Levin.
Interesting. Okay.
And you can find the comments by going to the ICANN website. And
I tried that. That's why I asked you.
Okay.
I think I spent 20 minutes searching for the
com is. I think I started at the GNSO website.
Okay, I'll forward the URL to the list as well.
All right.
Okay, any other questions about that process? Okay, so finally, our last topic today is to briefly review the terms of reference, the draft terms of reference that Bruce has posed. Once again, this is just a draft. It hasn't been acted upon by the council yet, and the council has a meeting on Thursday, I believe, where they will discuss and hopefully give us new terms of reference. Certainly as an input to that, if we had consensus recommendations or recommendations that were broadly supported by the task force relating to those terms of reference, I'm sure the council would take them under advisement, although they're under no obligation to do so. If anyone has feedback or comments they'd like to make regarding the terms of reference, we could see if there's anything that we all agreed upon that we'd like to forward to the council.
Jordan, this is Milton.
Yeah, Milton. Anyone else want to speak to this?
I do. It's Marilyn.
Marilyn. Okay, go ahead, Milton.
Yeah, our constituency has been going over this terms of reference, and we will be submitting a set of amendments to Bruce. They may already have been sent to Bruce, I'm not sure, but I am not sure whether they would be considered consensus points of this task force, so I'm not sure whether I should bring them up to discuss them here, but I'd be happy to do so if there's interest in that.
Well, if you believe that you could convince people to make some consensus points of view of the task force, you're more than welcome to attempt to do so for a moment here.
Okay. Well, some of them are pretty simply kind of clarification ones. In the first paragraph, we replace the words maintain stability and security of with coordinate the Internet's unique identifier systems. The sentence about how the current RAA defines the purpose of who is simply restructured a bit to make it clearer. However, we want, in the second paragraph, we want to define the primary goal of the task force in a slightly different way. We would like to see the primary goal defined as reconciling the WHOIS requirements of the RIA with the need to ensure privacy protection for personal data of individuals that may be registered name holders or the administrator or technical contact for a domain name. We think that's a much clearer focus for the task force, and when we say improve effectiveness of the WHOIS service, you're basically opening the door to 100 potential modifications of all different types, shapes, and sizes. And given the fact that, you know, we've been sort of working on this for 2 years and really haven't produced anything yet, we would like to see a much clearer focus. And that, in line with my comments last week, again, we feel like the sort of access and privacy issues have to be resolved before we can have a coherent position on accuracy. So what we've done is we have proposed that the first three tasks be retained in the terms of reference and that the fourth task be deferred.
Okay.
And Kathy, were there any other changes that you thought were important? I know that you had some contribution to that, and I may not have covered everything.
Everybody had an hour or two? Just kidding.
It was about 1 minute.
And I'm not sure how much of this will come through. I think that let's go down to the goals section, that the goal is to ensure privacy protection for the personal data of individuals. I would certainly expand that to be I'd change personal to be sensitive, because that's a word that was used, I believe, repeatedly by Task Force 1. The sensitive data of individuals, organizations, and then perhaps include companies. Of course, the issue for us in non-commercial is the nonprofit organizations involved in so much civil rights and human rights, civil rights, all sorts of areas where you don't necessarily have to know where the physical person is, but it's the message that's getting out that is, of course, protected under national law and under the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. So, again, I changed, you know, I don't know if other people would agree, but let's put it out there, personal data of individuals to look at the sensitive data of individuals, organizations, and companies. In Australia, they actually pulled off, .au pulled off the data of companies as well as organizations and individuals. So it's not just, you know, a United States issue. It seems to be a global issue on this
just
that we're looking at.
Just to clarify, Kathy, sorry to interrupt, which specific term were you referring to making a modification to here? I just kind of lost track of...
Do you see the second, I believe it's the second paragraph, the goal of the WHOIS task force, is that right, is to improve the effectiveness of the WHOIS service and maintaining the...
Oh, you're talking about the preamble here. Okay.
Yep.
Well, we deleted that language. We propose to delete, improve the effectiveness of the WHOIS service in maintaining the stability and security of the Internet's unique identifier system while taking into account where appropriate, and replace it basically with the statement, the primary goal of the WHOIS task force is to reconcile the WHOIS requirements of the RAA with the need to ensure privacy protection for the personal data of individuals that may be registered name holders. So Kathy wants to, instead of just saying personal data, you want to say sensitive data.
Of individuals, organizations, and companies that may be registered name holders.
Okay, so let me...
And then I had a question as well.
I'm very conscious of time, and Marilyn's waiting in the queue, so let me see if I can just put to the task force a couple of concrete questions here as to whether we think these are consensus views of the task force. First, does anyone have an objection? I think I know the answer to this. Does anyone have an objection to removing the fourth proposed work item relating to how to improve the process for notifying a registrar of inaccurate WHOIS data, ... from the terms of reference?
I do, Jordan.
Okay, so...
So do I. This is Steve.
Yeah, I didn't think that was going to be a consensus view of the task force. So the second would be...
Does that mean that two people have objected to it and two people have opposed it?
Well, that means that everyone's
You might want to hear from a few more people on this, I think.
Well, I think, Ross, to the extent... We have a very limited amount of time, and to the extent that there's disagreement about any of these things, we mm-hmm. wouldn't forward them as consensus views of the task force to the... I think anyone's free to make these recommendations to the council, and the discussion's appropriate at the council level.
Then just a small, minor quibble, then. We should perhaps be talking about things where we've got unanimous agreement on versus consensus.
Okay, correct. So I will say, I will then say that we're trying to identify things here that have the unanimous support of the task force forward to the council for consideration. Other than that, I think any individual constituency or task force participant is free to make their views known to the council for consideration on Thursday's discussion.
Actually, Jordan, I think that the task force members should be posted through the task force list, and then we could have a readout, perhaps, of what's posted at the council.
Sure, that's a very useful suggestion, Marilyn. So to the extent people have feedback they'd like to make, posting it through the task force list, and we'll make sure that gets presented to the council on Thursday. There are a number of council members present in the task force.
Can I ask them a question, then? This is Kathy.
Let me briefly let Marilyn go ahead, and then I'll try to come back to you.
My comment's pretty short, I think. I don't think that we probably do have unanimous agreement about many of these points, but question to the task force is, I thought what we were trying to do is to get a unified terms of reference that covered the existing work of the original task forces that are now collapsed into. And I just wanted to verify if people think that three then would be where we would cover our work on tiered access. That seemed to me to be the logical placeholder, but I just wanted to ask other people's opinions on it.
Yes, that's, this is Milton. Determining which data element should be available for public access. You're right in that this does not specifically raise the issue of tiered access, and perhaps it should in some way, but...
I think actually, Milton, tiered access was our solution to that challenge before. I just wanted to be sure that others would agree that that would be where we would hang the work on tiered access.
Well, I would, if I may, Jordan.
Yeah, go ahead, Ross.
I would be careful about using that as a placeholder for tiered access exclusively, in that there's actually two tests here. One, certainly that second sentence must include a conversation and likely a conclusion that discusses tiered access, the implementation of some sort of tiered access. But certainly the, at least in my read, the most important part of that statement is first determining what should be made available. So we need to really make sure that we're conscious of that sort of double-edged nature of that particular item.
Yeah, I mean, I think, just to expand on that, Marilyn, I would view the third element as incorporating tiered access, but certainly it doesn't appear to me to be limited to that. But the second sentence does seem to encompass tiered access as a valid topic.
I'm happy with that interpretation. That was the kind of the interpretation I had. I just, in going through the work we had underway and the purpose of this TOR, I wanted to be sure that we were incorporating the existing work that we're doing.
Jordan, this is Steve Metalis. Could I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead, Steve, and then I'm going to go back to Kathy.
Well, it really follows on to what Marilyn said, and that is, are we sure that this document also covers the two recommendations that are still in process, the one that we'll talk about next week on notification and consent, and the one on the procedure for conflict with national law? Do those fit in here somewhere, or are we assuming that this is just a forward-looking TOR, or what?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point, because I don't think those are necessarily incorporated in here. And to the extent, there's been discussion on the list and elsewhere with people expressing viewpoints as to whether or not those actions should be included in our ongoing work. So I don't think that there's going to be a unanimous view on either of those points, but I think... I would note that it does not appear that those are included in the terms of reference, and that it would be, without an explicit ruling one way or the other from the council as to what we were supposed to do with those action items, it would be difficult for me as a chair to figure out what we were supposed to be doing if it just happened to be that this was passed without discussion of that point.
Jordan, it's Marilyn. I'm just going to comment in my councilor role.
Certainly.
I've taken the position before on the council and will continue to take the position that terms of reference are intended to guide the work of a task force, and that, therefore, terms of reference, to me, would need to encompass the existing work.
Yeah, Marilyn, I agree that's why I said it would be difficult for me to figure out what to do with the existing work if there was no discussion about it at the council level and it was simply not included in the terms of reference, because I would feel that a big gray area developed.
Yep.
And so I know that some people have expressed the opinion that some of the work that we've already done ought not to be the focus of the task force, and I think that's an appropriate topic for discussion at the council level. But I think if the council decides to have us go forward or not, I think we could all agree that we would ask the council to be explicit in declaring which of our work we should proceed with and which we should not.
Jordan, I have questions on two new formative points, so if you could just drop me in the queue and then pick me up wherever appropriate.
Yeah. Okay, Kathy and then Ross.
Fast question. I don't. Are people looking at the draft terms of reference? Fast question for anyone who's on the name of the council. Under task one, there's a quote. It says to review the purpose of who is and determine whether it should be refined in the context of ICANN's mission. And then there's a quote. Where does that quote come from? Is that what we're binding the new task forces to, or is that what the task forces are looking at? The purpose, it says the purpose of who is to provide accurate technical and administrative contact information regarding any problem.
I think that comes from the current
that's the current definition of the purpose.
Is that right, Maria? When you got pulled that, I think you pulled this quote before. Did it come from the RAA?
I think Bruce took it from the introduction of that big paper I wrote a while ago, and that's from. It's actually taken verbatim, as far as I know, from the RAA.
It is, if I may weigh in, that's what's in the RAA now, and the purpose of the task force is to examine that.
I would put a citation. I'd like to recommend putting a citation in. So
we did that in our, you know, we put quotes around it in our modification.
It does have quotes now. It's just not cited as to where it comes from.
It has quotes in the second citation, but it doesn't in the first. In the first paragraph. We modified that to say the current RAA defines the purpose of who is as, quote, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Russ, we're running very low on time here.
Yeah, no problem. Real quick. I've got three bits. The first is we need to know whether or not this is new or revised terms of reference. Obviously, there's two different processes to follow if this is one or the other. More important, if this is a new term of reference for a new task force, we will obviously need to create a current and authoritative list of our outstanding work and figure what that go-forward process looks like, whether that's handed to the new task force or dealt with this one or put into a queue for future work. My third bit is that, and I've raised this on I've responded to this already, but it should be brought forward just as a for completeness sake, the clause, I believe it's the third one that deals with definitions, most of that work was picked up by the transfers task forces. They're under Exhibit C of the policy that the board had blessed. So those are my three bits.
And Ross, and that is now consensus policy.
That is correct.
So can I make a couple brief suggestions I think that hopefully we would have support for within the task force? First, that we ask that they specifically that the council specifically clarifies as to whether the ongoing work that we were doing in each of our work areas, and I can write a brief summary, are still considered to be in the scope of the task force on an ongoing basis. Secondly, that the council clarifies whether the task force is a new terms of reference or revised, and whether we should consider that the task force is being shut down and rechartered. And then third, maybe to add some clarifying language to the terms of reference on that particular point to refer the task force to the work of the transfers task force on that particular topic of the roles of the various contacts.
As it relates to the newer revised terms of reference, there's a couple of outcomes there that we should be conscious of. This could be a new terms of reference for an existing task force. This could be new terms of reference for a new task force, revised terms of reference for the existing task force.
Right, so there's three variations.
And any of those variations will put certain things in or out of scope. So I want to be real clear from a procedural perspective exactly what it is that we're dealing with so that we can react accordingly. That will really, I think, drive whether or not some of this existing work is in scope, for instance.
Okay. So, thank you. I realized, actually, before, what I'm going to do is I'll try to write up some of these points, and I'll email them to the list, and we can see if we can get the blessing of the task force on the list to forward it to the council. Those points, at least, unless people are just being quiet here, is anyone... have an objection to those points at a high level?
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the idea that the existing work should be incorporated in the new terms of reference. I would like to hear more from Ross about the implications of doing that or doing that, but I would like this to be a forward-looking terms of reference in general.
I think we need to deal with the formative issues first. In other words, is this proposal that Bruce has put forward considered to be, for instance, a revision of our existing charter? And if it is, then we continue with the same membership. We've got some questions to ask around existing work. If this is intended to be a new terms of reference for the existing task force, then that would put most of our existing work out of scope, except for the stuff where we've already made final recommendations. And again, that's really subject to whether, you know, what that final term of reference looks like. But as it currently stands, it would probably put some of this work out of scope. I'm not saying, I guess I just did say what my preference is, but, I'm not saying definitively what should be in or out of scope. We can have a conversation around that, but at least I want to know from a procedural standpoint where we stand so that we can make our, advocate for our position, right?
Jordan, I want to make a comment as a counselor about this.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
If the task force does not intend to fulfill its work, and I'm not making a statement one way or the other about whether I agree with that or not, I'm just merely giving you something to consider as a task force. You have the terms of reference. The terms of reference are going to be modified. All these questions are valid questions. But if we're not going to work under existing terms of reference, those terms of reference have to be sunsetted, and the work has to be, and there has to be some kind of report to council closing off the work or proposing why it should be closed off or proposing the end of the terms of reference, et cetera. I mean, we can't just say, okay, fine. So we got to figure out what it is if is being proposed.
Yeah, I agree, Marilyn. I just think that I would hope, and I'll try to draft some language and we can put it to the list because we won't have time to work it here, that the council will be clear, as Ross indicates, in indicating what its intent is for each of our current as well as any additional work items as to how we should proceed with them, whether it be sunsetting them or whether it be continuing to work on them or something else.
And can I just suggest, if Maria could do this, please, it would be very helpful if you could clip, Maria, those definitions in Exhibit C and send them to the list as well so that everyone has easy access to the definitions that are presently consensus policy.
Sure, Marilyn, I'll do that.
Okay, so I think we're going to have to leave it at that. I will try to draft up some recommendations for the council based on our dialogue today, and we will try to work them on the list and get them in a form that everyone can agree to so that we can forward them to the council as the unanimous sort of recommendation of the task force. And to the extent we can't do that, then we'll just hope that the counselors on the call can hear what we've said today and take it under advisement. Okay, thanks everyone. We will be talking next week about trying to formulate a final report for the notification work item, which we should have the public comment period completed on, and Maria should have drafted an initial or a draft final report for us to review by that point. So thanks, and we'll talk again next week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan. Bye.
Thanks, Jordan.